Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. I'm Grant Reher. My guest today is Mary Beth Pfeiffer. She's an investigative journalist and the author of a new book titled Lyme, The First Epidemic of Climate Change. Mary Beth, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me, Grant.
Well, you were a reporter for many years, an investigative reporter at the Poughkeepsie Journal, and that's where you first started writing about Lyme disease, and you did that for many years. I'm curious to know, as just an introductory question, what made you decide to go deeper into this and to write an entire book on it?
Well, first, I live in an area of the world, the Hudson Valley, that has among the highest rates of Lyme disease. So it was something that was certainly on my radar for a very long time. I knew many people who had Lyme disease. I, in fact, had two very short and easily treated cases. But I didn't view it as an investigative story, which is why it took me a while to get to it, frankly. And when I started looking into it, I found many, many issues to explore. Patients who couldn't get treatment, tests that failed, treatments that didn't work. So this is what kind of put me on a path for, frankly, the last 6 years, and eventually led to a book that puts all of that into context, I think, and with the larger context beyond the health issues being the environmental ones, the one that is driving this, namely climate change.
I want to get to that a little bit later, but let me take something else that you also mentioned, which was the response of the medical community. You argue in the book that the medical community has minimized and underestimated the dangers of Lyme disease, and I think undertreated it as well. Can you explain that a little bit, the different ways in which you found that to be the case?
Yes. Well, since the first treatment guidelines were released in the year 2000, so virtually for a generation now, Lyme disease has been framed as an illness that is pretty easy to diagnose with our standard two-tier test, as it's called, and relatively straightforward to treat with short courses of antibiotics. Both of those premises are being challenged in the scientific literature, and they have been for some time. Tests fail people at many stages of the disease, most often early, but even when it's well advanced. And the short course treatments of antibiotics still leave about 10 to 20% of people ill for weeks, months, even sometimes years after infection. So these are the issues that are really at the heart of Lyme disease that need a lot more attention, and those guidelines really need to be revisited.
And why do you think there hasn't been more attention and hasn't been more proactive responses to the shortcomings that you just identified?
Well, I think that there hasn't been enough attention to this because the Centers for Disease Control in the United States and major medical societies and journals basically have coalesced around this model of Lyme disease, that the tests work and the treatments work. And the power of those groups has really stymied a lot of research that needs to come to the fore. It has stopped often scientists with countervailing viewpoints of Lyme disease from getting grants and getting published. So it's really kept things from moving forward. And the reason for that is that our model of Lyme disease is really built around the early stages of the disease, when you get the rash, when you get the flu-like symptoms, which in and of themselves usually are diagnostic. The rash itself is diagnostic. If you're treated early, you're pretty okay as far as outcome goes. But if it gets out of control, there's a serious, serious problem. And that's the part of the population of Lyme patients that these guidelines do not address.
Well, let's talk about the disease itself for a minute. What is the prevalence of the disease at present in the in the United States, and if you want to break that down by areas of the country, please do. And then I'm also curious to know, when in the past did this disease really take hold, and what kind of growth arc has it been on?
Well, first and foremost, it's been on a huge growth arc. 20 years ago, Lyme disease-toting ticks were found in about half as many American counties as they are today. Today, they're in 3,000 counties. Hmm. It's huge. Primarily, though, the infection, the disease, has been centered in the Northeast and the Midwest of the United States, where rates are very high, where you talk to people and almost everybody has a Lyme disease story. But it's also been moving through the South into California, the Pacific Northwest. I'm going to a conference next week in Colorado. I just went to one in Arizona. Lyme disease is well along in many of those states. And for the residents there, when it's early, when it's new, when it's emerging, the danger is most acute because doctors don't recognize it. It has, as I said, been minimized as a disease, easy to diagnose, easy to treat. So people, doctors in particular, don't look for it. So in short, it's really spreading. It's a huge epidemic in the Hudson Valley, in other areas of New York, in central New York, where you're located. People need to be aware that this danger is out there, that ticks are very prevalent.
I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with Mary Beth Pfeiffer, the author of a new book titled Lyme, The First Epidemic of Climate Change. You were mentioning this earlier about some of the experiences you've had in the Hudson Valley, and I have to confess that I had a little bit of trouble at first being convinced that the disease wasn't being taken seriously enough. And I think that's because of where I live, maybe, and where I have lived. I went to graduate school in Connecticut, and I remember it was a big deal then in the 1980s. People were talking about it, and now up here in New York. And I have to say also, when I was reading your book, and now, even as I'm talking, I'm feeling ticks crawling around on my body.
Sorry about that.
That's okay. I'm curious to hear a little bit more about the lack of the medical community's awareness and reaction to it. I mean, you just said there that, you know, doctors in the Midwest are now beginning to think more about it, and they haven't really focused on it. It's hard for someone, I guess, who's been here to really get a grasp on that.
Well, doctors basically follow the guidelines that they are given. They read the medical literature. In particular, they'll read these reviews of Lyme disease that come out with some regularity. And the reviews repeat over and over again what I call Lyme dogma, that the tests work even when they fail more than 50% of the time early in the disease, and progressively get better, but still even fail people who are in the late stages of the disease. So even though, as you say, people talk about it, they know of these problems, they know of children who, for example, have missed months of school sometimes. I talk to mothers who tell me those kinds of stories all the time. There's sort of another reality among the medical community, which is forced, basically, to follow these inadequate guidelines. Mm. So they're almost like, it's a dichotomy, two views of Lyme disease, what's going on in the real world and what's going on in the medical literature, and the literature is what doctors have to follow. That's the problem.
Is there a better test that's being developed, or any effort to develop a better test? You mentioned a lot of false negatives. My understanding, too, is that the test can also yield false positives.
Yes, it can yield false positives, but I think those have been greatly exaggerated at the expense of people whose diagnoses are missed. But yes, there are many efforts going on right now to develop new tests. The National Institutes of Health spends millions of dollars to fund research on new tests every year. It's not enough, I would add, but it makes a statement that the NIH knows there's a problem with these tests. And, you know, I expect probably in the next couple of years that a new test will come along, but we have been working with the same test since 1994, and we have known it is problematic for many years. And it's really unconscionable that we are still using this test. It's time to retire it and move on to something else. What often happens is that doctors who specialize in treating Lyme disease, very courageous doctors, I would add, do resort to other laboratories with their own diagnostics. These are not accepted, however, by the CDC as confirming Lyme disease. So there's a real tug of war going on now as to how to diagnose it properly.
And what do you think, then, the medical community should be doing more generally regarding this, in terms of beyond the test, in terms of research, as well as guidelines for care that it's not doing? What would be your recommendations?
Well, I think physicians, first of all, have to be a little bit more inventive and courageous, if you will, to veer off of these very dogmatic guidelines. Lyme disease, and it even says this on the CDC website, can be a clinical diagnosis. In other words, a doctor can look at a patient, assess the risk of being bitten by a tick, maybe see that the person reports being bitten by a tick, and say, I think you have Lyme disease, I'm going to treat you. This generally doesn't happen, though. What happens is the physicians follow the existing guidelines, which say you either have to have that Lyme disease rash or you have to have a positive test. The problem with that is many people don't get the rash, or it's not recognized, or it's in a place where it's not seen. It has many variations, so they get undiagnosed. So that's the first thing. Doctors need to be a little bit more courageous and need to veer off of these very rigid guidelines. We also need a lot more research as to how to treat this disease. We need more clinical trials. We rely basically on four old, very limited, and highly questionable clinical trials, trials that have been questioned in the medical literature as inadequate. So I guess those are the first two things I would say we need to do.
You're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm talking with Mary Beth Pfeiffer. We've been discussing her new book on Lyme disease, which is titled Lyme, The First Epidemic of Climate Change. Mary Beth, I wanted to turn to now the experience of the folks who've had this disease and have had to deal with it. And I'm wondering, in part, if there is a bit of, for them, a bit of social stigma that surrounds this disease. Did you encounter that at all in their efforts to get better treatment?
There is, in fact, a not so much a stigma, but an avoidance by medicine to deal with Lyme disease. You had mentioned overdiagnosis as a problem, false diagnosis. I checked the medical literature when I wrote my book, and there were, in fact, 30 papers that dealt with false diagnoses of Lyme disease. The first one finding that a share of patients, about half of patients who were tested in one laboratory tested positive, that is, tested negative in another one. This led to a great deal of what I call copycat science. And basically, to me, these papers questioned the ability of the test, frankly, to diagnose. But instead, the message that got out to physicians was don't falsely diagnose Lyme disease. Be careful. It's part of that tamp it down mentality about Lyme disease. On the other side, though, there were only five papers that I could find dealing with underdiagnosis of Lyme disease. Now, if you falsely diagnose Lyme disease, you get a couple of weeks of antibiotics, which are among the safest drugs there are. If you miss a diagnosis of Lyme disease, you may be destined for a very long siege and in many cases, a disease that is not possible to cure. And many patients are put in sort of this holding pattern where they may be able to get a physician periodically to give them some antibiotics which help them but do not make them well. Mm. But the typical thing that happens to someone who goes undiagnosed, whose Lyme disease gets out of control, is they wind up on this merry-go-round, doctor to doctor to doctor, because many physicians do not want to treat advanced Lyme disease because the medical literature doesn't acknowledge that it exists. Huh. Rather, the medical mainstream says one course of antibiotics, 10 to 28 days, almost always kills the Lyme bug. This is not what science is finding today.
And you argue, and it's right in the title of your book, that there's a connection between the trajectory of this disease and global warming. And when I have thought about it, I always thought that the story was more about the interaction between the animal population and the suburbs and the more urban areas. I mean, for example, here in Syracuse, it's been a growing problem in terms of the number of deer that are in the actual city. But can you talk about that connection then between global warming and this disease?
Well, you're certainly right that suburbanization and the way we live generally has really fostered this disease. There are more deer. We have these little forest fragments that we love to live near. We love to see nature. We love to interact with it. We like to see deer. But they are places that aren't quite in their natural balanced state. So there's too many deer. There's way too many mice, which play probably a bigger role in this epidemic than deer, or certainly as big a role. But then beyond that, there is very compelling evidence that a warmer climate has opened up vast new areas of territory for ticks. Ticks are moving, and science can actually chart the movement of ticks up latitudes by the decades, decade after decade further north. They're going into Scandinavia. They're going into Russia. They're in China. They're as far north as Siberia. I just got back from Canada. And it's a huge and growing problem. Canada is basically where the United States was a couple of decades ago with this impending epidemic. Mm. And there's also archival studies that show, for example, a tick could live at 800 meters up a mountain in the Alps in Europe, and it's now at 1,200 meters. Well, why? Because it's warmer and it's a nicer place for a tick to live.
And you say that Lyme disease is the first epidemic of climate change. I was wondering whether you see others out there on the horizon that you've thought about as you were researching this book.
Well, there's many diseases that are being fostered by climate change, without a doubt. The list is long. Dengue fever, malaria, West Nile virus, even typhus. These things are being fostered by a warmer world. But Lyme disease, to me, is somewhat different in that it really did not exist. I mean, we've long had malaria, we've long had typhus and other kinds of pathogens. Lyme disease really just emerged in the late 1970s. We know it was out there quietly existing in the environment for thousands of years, but it exploded just as climate change reached its sort of maturation, its critical mass. And it's also huge. It's worldwide. It's in many countries. It's all over Western Europe, as I said, in China. Australia has a huge problem. It's turning up in South America. So because of when it emerged, because of its huge impact on many populations, this is why I call it, with a lot of justification, I think, the first epidemic of climate change.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to The Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media, and my guest is the writer, Mary Beth Pfeiffer. What was the most, in all of your digging for this book, what was the most surprising thing you encountered that you just weren't expecting to find?
You know, I was really surprised at what I found when I started looking into Lyme disease. I expected to write a story or two as an investigative reporter for the Poughkeepsie Journal in the Hudson Valley on the trend in cases, and in particular, why I could get my dog vaccinated for Lyme disease, but I could not get my children vaccinated. Mm. I wanted to know this. But instead, I found people who just were clamoring for care. They remained sick with this disease, but doctors and mainstream medicine did not believe them. So I think that's really the biggest thing I found. Children who remained sick, who couldn't go to school, who lost many years of precious development time, all because they had been bitten by the wrong tick in the wrong place. Mm. And I felt that we really needed to pay attention to this, and I needed to bring attention to it. And just one other thing I would add, when I started writing my articles, this was another big surprise, I wrote for a relatively small newspaper, which gave me great support and gave me time to work on my articles. When I first started publishing them, the articles went viral. They went around the country. Mm. They turned up in other countries around the world. People were very interested in this. People were, in a sense, validated by my articles because it reflected the experience not only of patients and doctors and here in the Hudson Valley where I live, but in many other places as well.
And you alluded to this in what you were just saying, but in your book, you tell many individual stories about people and their experiences. I was wondering if there were one or two that really have stayed with you and perhaps even haunt you.
Yes, there are several. One in particular I would tell you is about a boy named Troy, who was about 10 when he was bitten by a tick. And he was treated briefly for Lyme disease, and a couple of weeks later got very sick. He was 75 pounds, lost 15 pounds, couldn't get out of bed, was dragging his leg behind him, had headaches, had intense flu-like symptoms that were really disabling. So he was put in a hospital for a week, and many, many tests were done. I read his records. At the end of this week, he was released from the hospital with a diagnosis of pain amplification syndrome. Namely, doctors thought it was in his head. Hmm. One doctor said it was schoolitis. Hmm. And he was given two antidepressants and sent home and told to get up every day at a certain time and do breathing exercises and things like this. Now, he had been diagnosed with Lyme disease. His mother tried to tell them that. She said to me, they didn't want to hear another thing about it. Now, what's most frightening, frankly, about this story is that this happened in the state of Connecticut. Mm. It happened in 2016, just a couple of years ago. This is the state where Lyme disease emerged, where it is well known. But doctors did not want to consider that this child might have had Lyme disease because this isn't what Lyme disease has been framed as. It's been framed as easy to treat, easy to diagnose, doesn't look like what this child had.
Well, you telling that story, I have to say, makes me think of my own. And as you say in your book, everybody has one, but I'm feeling very fortunate to have the doctor that I have because she has been very aggressive in reaction to this. And I've not had Lyme disease as far as I know, but I have had encounters with ticks. And so that you're putting that thought into my head. I'm wondering here just at the end, we've got just a few minutes left, if there are other writing projects now that you're considering that may spin off of this or may go in different directions or be inspired by this, what are you up to now?
Well, I certainly am looking forward to what's going to happen next with this epidemic. I want to see tests that diagnose people. I want to see treatments that are developed to help people get out of this mess that we're in. So those are some issues that I certainly will be looking into. For the time being, though, I am taking this message out to the wider world. The Lyme community is vast. It's huge. There are support groups all over the nation. They know the problems of ticks and what they can do. What I want to do is tell the wider world, both to warn them and to spur a little bit of the indignation that Lyme disease patients feel. We need to change this picture. There's something wrong with it.
And just as a final question here, and we've got about a minute and a half left, off of what you just said, what would be the single most important piece of advice that you would give then to people who think that they've had some encounter with a tick, they've had either the tick bite or they've discovered ticks on their body or in their house, whatever that may be, and they're going in to talk to their doctor about it, what would be the single most important piece of advice you would give them as they go into that examination room?
I would first ask patients or have patients inform themselves before they go to their doctor to see what the problems are and the pitfalls of Lyme disease diagnosis are. And then I would push the doctor very hard to explore what the implications are of their infection, to push for a diagnosis, to not wait until the disease advances before the test turns positive, which is a major failing of the test. We ask people to come back later. Maybe you'll test positive later. We don't want to let this disease fester. Tell their doctor, don't wait.
That was Mary Beth Pfeiffer. And again, her new book is titled Lyme, The First Epidemic of Climate Change. Mary Beth, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with me.
Thank you so much, Grant.
You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media, Conversations in the Public Interest.
The Campbell Conversations, Conversations in the Public Interest, was hosted and produced by Grant Reher, engineered by Tom Fazio, and edited by Jason Smith. The Campbell Conversations is a joint production of the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University and WRVO Public Media. To learn more about the program or to hear previous interviews, visit wrvo.org/Campbell Conversations.